KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland 5 Centers for the Arts, presenting the Soweto Gospel Choir Wednesday, October 17th at Arlene Schnitzer Hall, honoring Nelson Mandela's 100th birthday. More information online at portland5.com. That's Portland, the number 5.com. It's 8 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Native Voices from the Edge with Carrie and Amory is coming up in just about 1 minute. Press Watch at 9, 10, Air Cascadia, 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Ken Jones talks with Todd Davies, author of the new novel Report to Megalopolis or the Postmodern Prometheus. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comics artists. All here on KBOO. Go to the website, kboo.fm.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, on Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m., we'll celebrate Dia de los Muertos. Muertos Film and Music Night will highlight some of the Dia de los Muertos traditions of Mexico, Central and South America. We'll screen authentic Day of the Dead short films and feature live performances by Virginia Lopez, Mariachi Portland, and more. Again, that's a film celebration of Dia de los Muertos, Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:01 a.m. I'm Carrie Waters.
And I'm Amory Shack.
And you're listening to Native Voices from the Edge.
And we have to reunite. I said, better gather up our warriors, cause tonight is the big fight. Hey, 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 hey. Oh, 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 oh. Hey, 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 hey. Oh, 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 oh.
Good morning, everyone. We're so excited to be back again. This is our third month that we've covered for Joanne as she campaigns. Over the last year, we started last November celebrating Native American Heritage Month with some amazing Native voices from the Edge, and hopped back on in May, and here we are. What a wild ride it's been.
And so many callers as well. As yes. This is our first time, it's been really fun to hear. And we'd love to give a special shout out to one of our callers right now.
That's right. That's right. Harry, thank you so much. We received your package from last May. It was a long time a coming. They held on to it for us. Thank you so much, though. For those who may recall that conversation, we had a caller named Harry who called in last May and shared about his coin collection and some of the Native folks throughout history that are on coins, like, of course, everyone knows the Sacagawea coin, but there's also the Sequoia coin, the
Kotucker's coin,
the Jim Thorpe coin. We've got them all here, and it's been so much fun.
Truly, we're going to treasure these, so thank you so much for sending
yes,
those in.
Yes, shout out to Harry. Shout out to Harry.
That's right.
Yes. So today, we are going to continue our conversation about Indigenous Peoples Day, about the Indian Child Welfare Act, about some of these issues that you might not have heard of, or perhaps you did and you'd like to join the conversation. We will be taking calls throughout this hour at 503-231-8187. Again, that's 503-231-8187. So we are so excited this week to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. Did you see that that good old tweet from good old 45?
No,
about
I didn't.
Columbus Day. Well, some people edited it and it was really perfect.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he was going off celebrating Columbus Day and some folks took to it with a red marker and made some appropriate changes. So I appreciated that.
I have to look for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Check it out. But as many folks are aware, you know, there is an upswelling of support across our nation to shift away from celebrating Columbus, promoting genocide, all of that stuff, and moving towards celebrating the resilience of our indigenous people since time immemorial. So this past Monday, there were celebrations across the nation, you know, acknowledging that we need to recognize the resilience of our people. So often we're seen as, you know, weak or needy, and you know, there's so much to celebrate.
That's true.
So much to celebrate. So you know, I know that there were other cities that had started to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. I got calls from folks, you know, in Oklahoma, in Los Angeles. I saw amazing photos and, you know, celebrations that folks are spearheading across the country, which is so powerful.
It's true. And even outside of like larger contexts, having conversations. I had a really good conversation with a friend in my living room this past week and just, you know, what can I do to be an ally? And having that kind of question. And what I did plug for that friend was the Reclaiming Native Truth research that just came out. Do you know about that?
Tell me about it.
So it is bomb, but if you go to reclaimingnativetruth.com, that is the website for it. And it has really great messaging. You click on Share Our Message, and there's one that's a guide for allies, and it's called Changing the Narrative About Native Americans. And then there's also one for just Native peoples and organizations, so the people who already have the type of background and understanding and are trying to help just create the right message, and so that we can all step in when we hear a bias or when we hear incorrect information, like just being someone to also model the message and to ask questions. You know, if you know if someone's looking to be a better ally, that is a really great resource. Also beautiful images and, that are from Native photographers, and it's designed by I think her name is Crystal Echo Hawk. But also, so basically it's all a project that is from Native people, for Native people, and for our allies. And I love it. And anyways, so it was nice to have something to be like, actually, I have a resource for you.
I love it. Yeah, I also, you know, came across at some point over the last couple of years this website, native-land.ca. You know, because I saw a meme floating around this past Indigenous Peoples Day saying, do you know who the Indigenous peoples are on the land where you live?
Ooh.
So important. So important. Because so often, you know, the genocide and the erasure of our history is successful, you know, if you want to call it success. And so often people don't know and they don't think about the history of our land. So, you know, here, for example, in the Willamette River Valley, here on the Columbia River, we've got so many tribes and bands of peoples who have lived on these lands since time immemorial, either, you know, as a seasonal trading ground or fishing, hunting ground, and or living here permanently. And, you know, it's really important to call those folks out by name. I think about the Chinook bands of Malala, Tualatin, Kalapuya. There's so many tribes and bands that have called this place home since time immemorial that are now a part of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, and, you know, all of these confederations, you know, are comprised of many different smaller groups who are just kind of lumped together by the federal government way back when in the treaty days. And we need to recognize them individually and call them out.
Mm-hmm.
I think about, you know, for example, another thing that's been happening a lot lately is people have been reaching out about how to acknowledge the indigenous nature of our land in a respectful way. So I really appreciate that. And so it's sparked this conversation again and thought process in my mind about the importance of both being inclusive, because, you know, we don't know every single tribe and band that has lived here since time immemorial. So we want to make sure that we have inclusive language there. And at the same time, it's important to call out those specifically who have lived here by name, because otherwise, you know, it's contributing to that process of erasure and invisibility. And, you know, our duty, both as, you know, folks living here in the Portland metro area, and as visitors. You know, I know myself as a Tlingit tribal member, I'm not a member of a local tribe here in Portland. So I recognize my role as a visitor. I want to be a good caretaker of this land. I want to help elevate the vision of those that have lived here since time immemorial. So that's fun. And I encourage all of our listeners to do the same. Check out this nativeland.ca if you feel like it. And take a look. Just scroll around. There's a great map with territories and languages, and they acknowledge, there's a disclaimer as soon as you check it out, that this does not represent official or legal boundaries of Indigenous nations. Make sure to contact the nation in question. And it's a work in progress, so feel free to check it out if you like.
I'm going to check it out.
Yeah. Yeah, do it. And then, of course, you know, there's also the history of removal with your family heritage from Oklahoma. Is there,
that's true,
are there any reflections that you have on those shifting boundaries and, you know, the connection to place, you know,
where, yeah,
where you historically come from? And
I mean, Oklahoma is a completely different scenario, too, of Oregon and the relationship with the tribes that have been, you know, removed and put in Oklahoma, as well as just from that progress of the relationship with Oklahoma as a state, is definitely different. There's so much going on there right now, but so my descendancy is from the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes in Oklahoma. And, you know, I think I'll talk about it a little bit more later when we talk about one of our main subjects for just what's happened this past week for federal Indian law. But, you know, I think it just affects families in a huge way. And I think that that's like the heart of the matter of separation. But yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's a deep, deep topic.
Yes.
But yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, deeply interconnected to indigenous rights and rights to land, rights to water, rights to our resources. Of course, we have to have that conversation about climate change. I saw the UN report this week. I'm sure many of our listeners have heard of it. But the UN came out with a long-awaited report talking about the fact that if we really want to limit global warming, well, climate change, I'm going to call it, to 1.5 degrees Celsius, that would require a huge global effect, and that we have roughly 12 years to make this happen. So that's not daunting at all. But, you know, there are things that we can do, that we have to do together. You know, subsidizing clean energy, coming up with new mechanisms and ways to resource it. We had CONFAM from the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon join us this last week to talk about the Portland Clean Energy Initiative as a solution that we can take upon ourselves locally here in Portland to hold retail businesses accountable that make over $1 billion nationally and over $500,000 locally to go into a fund that would generate $30 million per year of revenue to go towards clean energy infrastructure, green jobs training, sustainable agriculture, and other innovative efforts that both reduce greenhouse gas emissions and promote social justice. So I think, you know, now more than ever, you know, particularly with, you know, the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation this last week, folks are recognizing the lack of action taking place at the federal level and the fact that, you know, we need to take it upon ourselves to take action locally. And when I say action, I don't mean personal action. If folks feel compelled to do that, that's great, you know. But we need systems change.
Right.
We need to address this at a systemic level, focused on the injustices that prevent our communities who have historically borne the greatest burden of climate change to benefit those communities. So there's that. There are other methods, you know, of, well, of course, you know, we've got these tariffs, the tariffs against solar imports. So we need to figure out ways to subsidize and support clean energy infrastructure.
And vote.
It starts with the vote, that's for sure.
Which ballots are dropping? When are they dropping, Carrie?
Less than a week away.
It's true.
Just a wonderful time of the year. And we've got so many amazing candidates, women of color who are running both locally and across the nation. I think there's an unprecedented number of women running.
Yeah, on that note, we should bring up the representative, the Kansas Republican official who basically attacked Charisse Davids, who is a native. She's running up against, what's his name? His name is Representative Kevin Yoder, but he basically, this thing came out and just what he said was, I don't even want to repeat it, but I mean, have you seen that story?
I have not. No, tell me.
Okay, well, I'm looking at Indian Country today. Basically, Davids, who is our girl, she would be the first Native American woman to ever serve in Congress and would be the first lesbian to represent Kansas. And basically, she had some hate message a few days ago from a Kansas Republican who I think she's running against, Representative Kevin Yoder, and it came out from a Facebook message that he had sent to someone else, and then it was broadcasted, but basically, like, what he said at the end of it was, you know, this Indian's gonna get sent back packing to the reservation. That was, like, the end of his quote. Yeah. And then he was forced to resign, I'm sure, because he did resign.
Wow.
But it's just that kind of situation. Like, But at the same time, the way that Davids handled it was, you know, on point, just on top of it, and did not let it break her stride. And just like, as we have so many women, Native women running across the country, I mean, it's like dozens. Like, I don't know how, the number exactly, but I do have my new Bethany Yellowtail shirt. She represents, and it has like 5 columns of 12 people or so. And I think, so there's a large number. I don't know don't quote me on the number, but, you know.
That is powerful.
Yeah.
I love it. We mentioned this last Thursday that we had Bethany Yellowtail join the Oregon Native American Chamber gathering. And it was so powerful.
It was so powerful.
Loved hearing her story. So for those of you that don't know, Bethany Yellowtail is a fashion designer based out of Los Angeles. And she's
the founder of Bee Yellowtail.
Yes, Bee Yellowtail. So beautiful. So she brings her indigenous heritage. She's Northern Cheyenne and Crow. And she's the designer and CEO for her line, Be Yellowtail.
Mm-hmm.
So she has brought her, she's taken advantage of her positioning as a fashion designer to bring Native models out into the field. You know, we were able to hear this amazing video of hers at the gathering this last week.
Mm-hmm.
And hearing her story was so powerful, as she, of course, sees the prevalence of Native-inspired designs throughout the fashion right. industry. And so I love, you know, I love her, Louis Gong. Mm-hmm. I think, is he the one who says inspired Natives, not Native-inspired?
Yes.
Yes.
Eighth generation.
Eighth generation. So for those of y'all who are familiar with Pendleton blankets, which are commonly gifted.
People in Portland love Pendleton.
In the Native community.
I just see it everywhere.
Eighth generation.
That's
exists.
Where it's at.
Yep. As a Native owned
yeah.
and operated
Keep
store.
Your Pendletons, but shop at Eighth Generation. It's just our own personal plug.
They're opening a store in Portland.
Oh, they are?
Uh-huh. Yes. I saw that Louis Gong was scouting out locations before this last gathering with the Oregon Native American Chamber. So keep an eye out. I'm not sure where they'll be sited. I think they were asking folks where, you know, should it be Hawthorne? Should it be Mississippi?
Yeah.
We'll have to see.
And what I love about his blankets as well is, and the other work that Eighth Generation creates, but there's a story behind every piece and there's meaning behind it.
I think there's a Bethany Yellowtail blanket.
There
right?
is. I have it. I want it at the
That's the right. That's right.
Anyways, I want it in a raffle, everybody. And it's kind of the best blanket. Mm. And I just had really great luck that day.
It's just the year of Be Yellowtail.
It is. But even that blanket, I will have to look it up a little bit more. But what I believe and what I remember it to be significant for is a coming together, because the tribes that she comes from are, I think that they might be feuding in history. But what the point of the blanket is to talk about unification, and it's her and Louis Gong coming together as artists, just like in today's culture and society, and just making beautiful bomb blankets. And
so powerful.
And it's gorgeous. But anyways, that's a total side note. Mm. Yeah, her video was so inspiring.
Love it. Yeah, she is an active supporter of women's rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a part of the video shared her at the 2017 Women's March on the National Mall. And she collaborated with another Montana artist, John Isaiah Pepillon, to create a custom design scarf for the Native women, each wearing a war bonnet.
Right. Because, I mean, at the intent of when that March, so old news right at this point, but when, you know, that march was happening, the Indigenous voices were left out, and so Bethany, you know, stepped in and was like, we need to be representing and be represented here.
Yes, absolutely.
It was great.
And let this all be a reminder, as the good old spooky Halloween season is upon us, please don't appropriate our people.
Mm-hmm.
And wear Native costumes. And I saw another meme going around about like other costumes that you shouldn't wear. You shouldn't appropriate anyone's culture. Take a long hard look before you dress up, if that's a thing that you do.
Yeah. And if you see someone, you know,
call
just
them
have
in.
A conversation. That's right.
Call them in.
Ask open-ended questions
out.
Maybe. And
what was your thinking behind dialogue. This? Yeah, I also saw that good old TikTok, which has been popping up throughout my Facebook feed like over and over and over again. Folks might recall Musical.ly, you know, where you, I think, lip sync to a song or something and can do fun little short videos. But they had a headdress filter, and they recently apologized for it and removed it, which is great. It's, you know, unfortunate that they did that to begin with, but at least they're recognizing it and apologizing for it. So that brings up this other conversation about, you know, we've got Native American Heritage Month coming up. I think one of our big topics that we covered last year was cultural appropriation versus cultural appreciation. And, you know, as I think about those that have lived here since time immemorial and what it would look like, what would it look like if Portland had the architecture, the, you know, the visual aesthetic and just the sense of the Native tribes that have lived here since time immemorial? And what is that line? What is that balance between cultural appreciation and cultural appropriation? Because, you know, I think about, for example, I went to Evergreen, go Gooey Ducks, go, up north. And there is this discussion about revamping the main student center. And, you know, I remember putting forth the idea, like, why don't we do another longhouse? You know, we've got the Evergreen Longhouse, which is a wonderful architectural feat with, you know, beautiful art and designs throughout it that recognize the Salish tribes and those that have lived on those lands since time immemorial. And folks dismissed it. You know, some of the administration said, oh, well, we already have the longhouse, and if we use that, you know, those designs here in this center, we'd have to do that for every special interest group. Mm. And so, you know, that sparks this conversation about, you know, Native tribes being distinct, sovereign political entities,
right,
as opposed to just another special interest group.
Right.
So, you know, I think about that down here as well. And, you know, in these designs with, you know, Bethany Yellowtail calling out the Native inspired designs and the importance of those designs coming from Native peoples, by Native peoples, for mm-hmm. our Native peoples. And I wonder, you know, like, what is that balance? How can we achieve balance between, you know, covering our entire nation in the designs of our peoples without that just being a superficial, you know, way of taking on the trappings of our people mm-hmm. while still perpetuating violence against our women,
right?
You know, appropriation. So that's just some food for thought for folks.
Also, if you want to be calling in and talking, just a reminder, we do have the lines open. You know, what are your thoughts about these subjects of cultural appropriation, or, you know, what was your experience with Indigenous Peoples Day? Call in.
Yes, 503-231-8187. Again, for those who are joining us, this is KBOO Portland. You're listening to Native Voices from the Edge. I'm Carrie.
And I'm Amory.
And we are covering for Joanne as she finishes campaigning. So thank you for allowing us to join in this morning. So, you know, shifting gears, there was another big piece of news that came out this last week down in Texas. Amory, would you
really
like to
beyond Texas too, give, but
give
yes.
an overview? There are implications nationwide. So what happened this last week?
So I just wanted to start by saying, I'm also, for those of you listeners that may be, you know, your own legal scholars, this is not a legal analysis of this case. This is just my personal sharing and, you know, what I've read and what I'm understanding about this very recent decision. But last Thursday, the U.S. District Court for Northern District of Texas declared the Indian Child Welfare Act, which is ICWA for short, if you don't know about it. They declared this unconstitutional, along with many other, you know, the act has new regulations from 2016. It's almost 40 years old in terms of being an act for federal Indian law, but all of that was deemed as unlawful. And this case was Bracken or Texas v. Zinke. I'm confused at why the name changes, but I also just don't know the background. Okay. But it's a case brought by Texas, Indiana, and Louisiana, actually. It started with just Texas, Texas's attorney general, and but it also includes individual plaintiffs, which were non-native foster families who were adopting a child who's a member of two tribes, and the intervening tribes and the federal government as defendants. So why this is a big deal for federal Indian law is it's the first time in the Indian Child Welfare Act's history that a state has sued the federal government over the act's constitutionality. And just to back up a second, for those of you that may not know, since its beginnings, the Indian Child Welfare Act has been contested. So it's just, you know, kind of court case after court case. And what's the thing that's troubling about it is that, you know, this judge, who it just seems like these kinds of decisions don't understand or care for hundreds of years of legal precedence. And it, you know, when they make judgments like this, in my opinion, like it is just, you know, it's threatening what the Indian Child Welfare does for Native children and families. So what the I guess I don't know if I actually said what the Indian Child Welfare Act is, but if you want to learn more about it, you can visit NICWA.org. But it's a law that you know what? I should just Google it really quick.
So it gives tribal governments a strong voice concerning child custody proceedings that involve Indian children, recognizing the longstanding history of removal from the boarding school era, from other times throughout our history where our people have been systematically removed, our children specifically removed from our families.
Right.
We've got a caller.
We do.
Sunny, you're on the line.
Good morning. Such a good show. Important
thank
topic.
You. Good.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies. Thank you know, we are a people, I'm of First Nations descent, and we are a people where anything that they can think of to take from us next or from the past, future, present, the 12th dimension, they'll take everything. But anyway, those are the bad hearts, and I called in about a matter that I think is important and could be significant to helping to turn this tide. Our deranged president has appointed Kanye West as an advisor on the terrible violence that Chicago is going through.
Wow.
And Kanye West has got a video called Monster, which features him sitting in a chair with the bodies of women hanging from nooses above him, all around his chair. And the video goes on to show him lying in bed with their corpses. Now, these are all white women, but were they black, red, yellow, or all colors altogether? It's just as terrible, and it is terrible to have this happen to any woman. And I think we can make the case that since this is a president who boasts about sexual assaults upon women, grabbing women's genitalia, then he's co-joined with a person that is actually putting out training videos for gang predation upon women in all the terrible neighborhoods of America, which are now the entire country. We can show that he is unfit, and we need to get together even with conservatives, many of whom will be appalled by this joining. We've got to give them that credit. And we can bring about a national strike where we stand strong in peace and we say he is unfit. This is absolutely a clear choice of his hatred, and we might be looking at big trouble. He is desperate enough for attention, and he is degenerate and corrupt enough that he might try to maintain power through launching a gang war upon us. Now, Kanye West fell out of favor with a lot of his, you know, domain, but if he can tell his followers, look, I'm right next to the president, look at all the power I've got, he could persuade them quickly to grab a hold of the opportunity. This is a great threat to all freedom, and let's not forget that freedom was here on these shores when many people from different nations came here. The people of our land, our First Nations people, had established a wonderful form of governance, Bill of Rights, that comes from the Iroquois and the Delaware and also many other nations.
That's right.
Benjamin Franklin acknowledges this. Jefferson even mentions it. But they claim everything for themselves, and yet good-hearted Americans of all colors, because we are one nation, acknowledge the truth of this, and they support the truth of it. And let's stand together. And we got to get this guy out before he launches a crime war on us like what Mexico's been going through. That's what I have to say. And thank you, please. I'll get off now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much
for calling
in, Sunny. Thank you.
Yes, we appreciate
Madison.
Love it. Well, no, I don't love. I love that you called in and shared that perspective. I don't love 45 or any of these horrible policies. Even just this morning, honestly, we were harassed on the street
as we
were walking over here. I don't know about the R word on the radio, but this man approached us and asked us multiple times, do you want to be R word? And it's just, it's a frightening time for white men.
Right.
Supposedly. So who said that recently? Was that Trump? It's a scary time to be a white man.
Oh my God. I don't even.
I'm just like, ugh. No. So with all of this context in mind, we've got this ICWA case.
We do. And I mean, just to back it up a bit too for our listeners, in case you don't know about the U.S. child welfare system, it is biased against Native families. And, you know, we know that our children are overrepresented in the foster care system at a rate at least two times greater than the proportions of the population. And there's, you know, national research that shows that, you know, Native children are removed from families and placed in foster care at a rate four times more often than their white counterparts, even when both families have the same presenting problems. In addition, you know, research also shows that families of color also receive less access to family support services that could reduce the need for removals in many cases. And, you know, back when ICWA was first, back in the 70s, it was really common for non-Native folks to cruise reservations or communities boarding reservations and just take kids. And, you know, when parents wanted to get their kids back, they would, it would be through state court. And I think that's the heart of the Indian Child Welfare Act and where it comes from. And, you know, you talked about it earlier, but just, you know, what our communities have gone through for our children and to protect them and the boarding school era. And do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I also think about what we covered this past May. So, you know, the city of Portland and many others recognized, is it May 5th? As Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Recognition Day. These are interconnected systems. There's a common theme going on here about tearing our women away from our communities as well as our children. And this goes back decades, centuries even, when there were actual federal policies, you know, here's a quiz for you out there. What was the first federal Indian policy? Extermination. When genocide didn't go as planned through extermination, you know, there was a series of policies that followed, you know, including assimilation, which was a part of that boarding school era, you know, which impacted my family up north in Alaska. My grandma was beaten for speaking the Tlingit language up at Sheldon Jackson Boarding School. And I know that there are so many other stories. Similarly, we've got, the Chemawa Indian School down here in Salem, which, is still in operation. It's a different, you know, different system, different structure. But, there are boarding schools across the nation that have this deeply troubling history.
Mm-hmm.
And so this isn't just, you know, some isolated incidents. You know, this is systematic. It's intentional. It's mm-hmm. institutionalized, embedded within our society.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about your experience, you know, mm-hmm. with ICWA. Like, do you have any reflections on, you know, your family's history pre-ICWA?
Yeah. Thank you for sharing yours, too, about your grandma. Yeah. Well, I can speak to my family history. My mom and her siblings, I have 5 aunts and uncles, and they're all members of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. They all were part of being raised, well, adopted out either as infants, but the older siblings, my mom and her sister, were, you know, they grew up in an Indian adoption home, or basically an Indian orphanage in southeastern Oklahoma with many other Native children from different tribes in the area as well. And they were all raised by white evangelical or Christian people of faith. And they were not allowed to speak their language there either, because they were being assimilated. And this was, you know, my mom, and I'm 30, and it's, you know, that is not that long ago. And if you even think about, I know we're talking about like longer past history, but if you, another quiz is, did you know in the 1970s, the federally funded Indian Health Services performed involuntary sterilization on over thousands and thousands of American Indian women, according to the U.S. General Accounting Office? Like, this is not ancient history. This is not, you know, in the far past. This mm-hmm. is still, a reverberation. And we're seeing that in very many different conversations across the country, but it's just something that we need to recognize too. It's real.
Mm. Yeah. So what can people do about this now, you know, with this court decision in Texas? What are the next steps? Does it go to district court, or details? And what happens next?
To my understanding, it's going to be appealed. But these sorts of cases, you know, are things that they take a while. But I think what's just, in my opinion, just a little bit unnerving about it is that this, you know, this is a judge who is making a pretty revolutionary, or just a new... This is the first time it's ever happened from states opposing, and, you know, what I'm trying to say is just that I'm not completely sure about mm-hmm. what this leads to, but it is distressing, and it's an immediate negative impact because, you know, it already affects families that are in state child welfare systems, especially for those states that were plaintiffs in the case. Mm. But I think I think it's uncertain because people are trying to seek protections under the law. But, you know, we don't want this to return to the pre-ICWA environment where Native children and families were removed at even larger numbers than they are now. The percentage has gone down with ICWA, just in the years. But, we need protections, and... I think that it is a shock to hear this and to learn about it. But I think that what's really cool is, you know, being able to see all of these statements from Indian Country and from so many national Native and non-Native organizations who are in this work, mobilizing and standing up and saying that, people are knowing that tribal sovereignty needs to be upheld, and the rights of Native people that are part of, you know, that's expressed in laws like the Indian Child Welfare Act. So I would say what people can do is just to learn about it and to educate themselves and learn about federal Indian law. I think that there's good education that we can all do for that, and learn about the statistics and the history of Native children, and, you know, how that history reverberates into our systems, like child welfare services that are lined up today. And, you know, just knowing and realizing that tribes, tribal leaders, and tribal governments, you know, are sovereign in their own right. And with that, you know, they know what's best for their families too. And like tribal child welfare systems and, you know, they have the best interest in mind, in my opinion, for the long term of, you know, being connected to culture, being connected to family. Like there's also research that shows like that connection, you know, reduces the likelihood to drop out of school or to have mental health issues or to struggle with addiction. And, you know, being connected to culture is a huge prevention plus for our communities. And, you know, we need our communities and to be around our culture to thrive best, in my opinion.
Yes. Yeah, we've got over 70,000 self-identified Native Americans here throughout the Portland metro area, which I don't think people always realize.
And I'm sure that number is larger.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about data.
Exactly. Exactly. The good old census. So, you know, something else that this conversation is reminding me of is, you know, all of these detention centers. Yet another systematic way of tearing apart immigrant families. You know, I saw that with these detention centers now being at capacity, that ICE has been releasing immigrant families to churches and other nonprofits, and it's just such a cluster. So, you know, if anyone wants to join the conversation, we've got just 15 minutes remaining in this hour of Native Voices from the Edge. You can call in at 503-231-8187. But yeah, this is happening, you know, to our brothers and sisters from the South. And, you know, there have been conversations, you know, within our Native communities, you know, about what it means to welcome immigrants onto this land, and still recognize those that have lived here since time immemorial. A friend of mine did a really great study back in college. I can't believe that was like 10 years ago. Talking about the historic trade routes from north to south. You know, we historically had lots of trade going on, you know, across nations from north to south as opposed to east to west, which is how people typically think about trade in this Eurocentric society. You know, and so oftentimes our communities are pitted against each other, and there's this culture of fear created, and this scarcity mindset, feeling like, you know, we have to protect our own, we have to do everything that we can for our own people. And yet, you know, we have to recognize that we're stronger together and that we can work to expand the pie and create an atmosphere, an environment of abundance when we build power across Indigenous peoples, across communities of color,
right,
and with our allies.
And on that note that you know just brought up, it totally ties into this recent ruling for ICWA, because in this article from the Washington Post from Megan Flynn, you know, she states that in this case, the Judge O'Connor found that ICWA, in quotes, offends the structure of the Constitution because it requires state courts to implement a policy unequivocally dictated by the federal government. And that same doctrine has been used by at least two federal courts in Pennsylvania and California to block the Trump administration's crackdown on sanctuary cities. So it's connected, and, you know,
it's absolutely all connected. You know, our destruction of our planet and our people, it's all connected. I love that, you know, the Women of Color Speak Out. If folks haven't heard these ladies, they're from Seattle. They've got a website. I believe it's wocspeakout.com or something along those lines. They've also got a YouTube page. And they really dive deep on these connections between, you know, our people being decimated and the destruction of our planet.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all important food for thought. It's difficult to hear at times, but, you know, shifting gears here, you know, briefly, you know, we've, as we mentioned at the beginning of the hour, you know, ballots drop within 1 week, and that's our opportunity to take action and to create that local change that we want to see. What are some ballot measures or candidates that are important to you?
let's see. I mean, definitely the Portland Clean Energy Initiative. If you missed that, you can also listen to the recording on KBOO's website. Are you guys just like perusing through KBOO's archive sometimes for just good stories? Because I am.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And you can also check out Portland Clean Energy Initiative.com.
Yes.
So that's a good opportunity to say yes amidst all of these fights against bad things that are happening. There's also that housing bond that we talked a bit about last May. That was referred by our Metro Council. Folks can check out Yes for Affordable Housing to learn more, but this is a regional bond because housing is a regional issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, while it's important to take action within city limits, you know, we're all connected and we aren't separated just by the boundaries of our jurisdictions. We're all impacted by the housing crisis. And then there's a bunch of no's that are, you know, running really great campaigns right now against like the grocery. So there's this proposed say no to grocery taxes or something along those lines that's kind of like preemptively getting in front of this soda tax that's been in discussion for quite some time. There have been other cities throughout the nation that have been passing these soda taxes, which, you know, it's tough. These issues are complex. You know, should we be taxing on soda in our community, you know, because it's destructive. It's not, you know, these sugary drinks are marketed to our kids. Like,
yes,
I saw this family walking by. So, you know, at one of our wonderful Native serving organizations in our community, they've been doing work on bringing attention to the marketing of these sugary drinks within our kids and bringing awareness to all of the delicious teas that you can harvest out in our forest lands here in this region. And through that work, conversations with my girl Jenny, hey, if you're listening, you know, I started to notice more and more, like I had been aware, you know, that, you know, tobacco companies are marketing to our kids. These sugary drink companies are marketing to our kids. But I'm noticing it more and more. I saw this family walking by a convenience store and these sugary drink ads were just at face level with this little one who was like, you know, 3 to 5 years old or something. And she was looking up and pointing to it like, I want that. I want that. And it's just so insidious, you know. And so, you know, as we approach these issues from the perspective of justice and thinking about what's right, you know, we have to both remove the bad and build the new and create these alternatives.
True.
But is a soda tax the right approach?
It's a great question.
Yeah. So, but there's these grocers that are coming together and they're trying to do a preemptive strike on this through this measure 103, I believe. I remember when, you know, folks were standing out collecting signatures and I was learning about it and I'm like, I'm not sure about this one because, you know, there are already, so I think this is a way to institutionalize these loopholes so they wouldn't have to pay taxes. And yeah, so that's happening. There's, of course, Measure 105, which is essentially removing our sanctuary state laws that exist and opening the doors to racial profiling. So I, you know, I believe that we have to stand in solidarity across our communities, and to fight these bad initiatives that are happening, but also to build the new and to come up with opportunities for folks to say yes, because it can get depressing out there, you know, when we're just fighting the bad all the time.
That's true.
Yeah. So lots of good stuff on the ballot, lots of amazing candidates. We are so excited to see how things pan out with Joanne.
Yeah.
And Loretta. It's Joanne's birthday coming up, by the way.
Oh,
oh, happy birthday, Joanne.
Happy birthday.
Oh.
And also, if because we're coming to the end of the hour, if you want to talk about the five measures on Oregon's ballot, you know, we can talk about it next week on Thursday. So call in.
Exactly. Yes. We're so excited to have Jarell Kalika joining us
yes.
next Thursday. So we're going to chat about the Portland State University Native Nations Institute. I heard recently, I know that there was recently a bachelor's program created for Indigenous Nation Studies at PSU. I think it was just a minor before, and now you can major in Indigenous Nation Studies at Portland State University, which is amazing. And they have a new director. And I heard him speaking recently about what it would look like to create a tribal college in Oregon and for that to be Portland State University. So what that would involve, as I understand it, is partnering with the tribal nations that live here in order to make sure that we're serving those people in a good way. So Jarell Kalika next week. We're going to be joined by Pam Fawn and the Community Alliance of Tenants to talk about tenant protections. And we may have a guest spot from Tana Sanchez, House District 43, as well. So I'm Carrie Waters.
And I'm Amory Shack.
Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week at Native Voices from the Edge.
Hey, hey, hey. Oh, oh, oh. Whoa. We are all one people and we have to reunite. I say better gather up our warriors, cause tonight is the big fight. Hey, 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 hey.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Saturday Market, 45 years of handmade arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, and local music in downtown Portland, featuring live music and Kids Corner events. Portland Saturday Market every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park, now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more online at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. It's 8:58. This is KBOO Portland coming up in just a couple of minutes. Teresa Mitchell has Press Watch with the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, today host Ken Jones talks with Todd Davies, author of the new novel Report to Megalopolis or The Postmodern Prometheus. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comics artists. And all of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Save the Village, an open house for community in action on Sunday, October 14th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Foster Village in Portland. Save the Village is an open house of Foster Village, which features tours, information of the skills and best practices of community living, live music, food, and celebration. There will also be the opportunity to learn more about the expansion of Foster Village through the purchase of the Orange House. Again, that's Save the Village, an open house for community in action on Sunday, October 14th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Foster Village, 4635 Southeast 64th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Women's Reproductive Rights Now on Sunday, October 14th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Sunnyside Community House, located at 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. Women's Reproductive Rights Now is an educational event to support activists fighting for reproductive rights. Speakers include Judith Harkana, Dr. Patricia Kohlberg, Reverend Emily Champagne, and Sally Castillo of Planned Parenthood. There will also be videos, tabling, food, and more. Again, that's Women's Reproductive Rights Now on Sunday, October 14th from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, on Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m., we'll celebrate Dia de los Muertos. Muertos Film and Music Night will highlight some of the Dia de los Muertos traditions of Mexico, Central and South America. We'll screen authentic Day of the Dead short films and feature live performances by Virginia Lopez, Mariachi Portland, and more. Again, that's a film celebration of Dia de los Muertos, Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.